The American History Podcast, Episode 4.
Welcome to the American History Podcast, hosted by Sean Morswick.
Welcome back. Today, episode 4, we're going to be talking about European empires in the New World, part 2, New France, New Spain, and American-Indian relations in North America. Now, first of all, I'd just like to get started with a bit of an overview about Europeans and American Indians in North America. Now, when the English or other Europeans looked at the American continent, what they often saw was a virgin land. Now, of course, as we have previously discussed, the Americas were far from the unpopulated virgin land the Spanish and the British imagined that it was. But we need to look at it from their perspective. This way we can understand or gain an understanding of why they felt the way they did. Now, the noted economist-turned-historian Murray N. Rothbard tells us in his fantastic four-volume Colonial History of the United States that Europe was plagued by feudalism at this time and statism, absolute monarchy, state-controlled churches, state restrictions on human labor and human enterprise. He says there was scarce land, which was itself engrossed by feudal and quasi-feudal landlords whose vast government-granted estates drained what little surplus the peasants could earn. So to these people, the new and vast lands of the Americas appeared heaven-sent. The clear majority of European middle class and peasants faced centuries of struggle against restrictions of all sorts. There was restrictions of their status, there was a heavy tax burden, as well as controls that were foisted upon them by states and their allies, the guilds. And if you don't know what a guild was, that was basically like a union of craftsmen that were all of the same craft. So you might have like a union of glassmakers, the Guild of Glassmakers, or something like that. The Americas, on the other hand, was unencumbered by the feudal restrictions that these people were facing at home. In other words, the lands of America represented the chance for the individual to leave his unsatisfactory conditions at home to try and carve out of the wilderness a new life for him and his family. In the New World, he could enjoy freedom and the chance to stand on his own two feet in a way that his ancestors could never have imagined. And so this was revolutionary. This was an opportunity that had not been around for a long time, and the way these people saw it, may never come back again, okay? Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about New France first, and then we'll get into New Spain and its relationship with the Native American peoples. I should also note that this is simply an overview of these relationships. We're going to get into far more detail at numerous points throughout the remainder of the podcast. One example is there will be a future episode far down the line, but we're going to talk about the Native Americans and their effects on, for example, the U.S. war with Mexico. All right, but let's go in, like I said, let's get into New France. Out of all of the European powers, the French were the most successful in creating an effective trading relationship with the Indians, by far. As a matter of fact, historian Richard White, in his 1991 book, The Middle Ground, notes that in the Great Lakes region, there was weak state authority that existed here, and this place was what he called a middle ground. This was a process, basically, of mutual accommodation between the Algonquian-speaking Indians and the French traders at first, but later it came to include the British and even the Americans. I think this is important because there was a lack of state power here, and due to the lack of state power, these European traders traded peacefully. They engaged in peaceful commerce with the native peoples. Now, one of the things, just to say about the English real quick, is that English settlers in general tended to seek to either remove or exterminate American Indians. Of course, this wasn't always the case, as we just saw with the Middle Ground around the Great Lakes region, but that is or tends to be their MO, at least in general. Now, again, if you were one of my students, one of the things I always tell students is that all of these things are dependent on time and place. Different time, different place, you're going to see different things, okay? I'm painting with a broad brush here, and I just wanted to point that out. Now, the Spanish, quickly, they sought to Christianize Indians and to use them as a forced labor group. Okay, so, of course, this is far different from the French. The French are really just interested in trading, and they become very much good at this because they're great at giving gifts to the native peoples. And it may sound kind of weird, but the key to getting on with American Indians was gift-giving. They based intertribal relationships upon gift-giving, and the French figured this out pretty quickly on and started engaging in this activity as early as the late 17th century. Now, to the natives, trade was not seen as a transaction. It was not seen as a contract the way the Europeans saw it. The Indians saw trade as a continuing process. And if one group was to stop trading with another group, this was seen as tantamount to declaring war. So if you had kind of started to trade with somebody, or even if you didn't, and that could be seen as a declaration of war, something that the Europeans did not really understand. So what were they trading for? What were the French interested in gaining? They really were interested in the beaver trade, okay? And the beaver trade led to the exploration of much of North America, and this is because there was a heavy, heavy demand for fur in European fashion, and the beaver was the main animal that was providing this fur. Now, what did American Indians gain? The Europeans gave them firearms, alcohol, pots, glass beads, just all sorts of different trinkets, but the main thing was firearms and alcohol are the main things. Now, as far as the French were concerned, they had this group of rough frontiersmen who sought to trap into the lucrative fur trade. They were called the Runners of the Woods. I'm going to try to say it in French, but I'm going to butcher it, so please forgive me if you're listening in France. But these were the Coureurs de Bois. Anyways, yeah, I tore that apart. There was also a group of French seamen who befriended and recruited Indians into the fur trade. Remember, we're talking about the Great Lakes, but also on the coastal areas as well. Now, the French, because of all this, would also expand and begin to explore the Mississippi Valley. And this also resulted in trade relationships that they were able to develop in the southeastern portion of what is today the United States with the Native Americans. But it wasn't just the French. When you look at the French Empire, like the Spanish, they were also Catholic. But the Spanish tended to be more allied with the Dominican group of Catholic priests, whereas the French, it was the Jesuits. And the Jesuits were Catholic missionaries who were seeking to convert these native peoples and to save them from the fur trappers. So you actually did have a little bit of tension between the French trappers and traders on the one hand and then the Jesuits on the other hand. One of the things, though, that the Jesuits did was that they tried to convert the natives through example rather than by force. And this is definitely different than what you would have seen in the Spanish Empire. The Spanish Empire, the Dominicans tended to use force first, or that was kind of their MO. Now, some of these Jesuits were actually brutally murdered by American Indians, although in the eyes of these American Indians, they had actually a great amount of respect for the Jesuits, and that's because out of all of the European groups, Jesuits tended to best hold up to torture So they killed them, but they had a bit of respect for them as well. And the Jesuits were also playing a vital role as explorers and geographers. So it wasn't just these rough frontiersmen, okay? There were priests as well. Now, one of the things that you're going to see with the French is that many of these French men who came to New France ended up marrying American Indian women. And this cemented ties between the two cultures. You actually see that in the film with Leonardo DiCaprio that came out a few years ago called The Revenant, where his character had married a Native American woman. Now, when you had a French male marrying to an American Indian female, the offspring, the children of these groups of people were called Métis, the Métis. And so that leads us to talking about now a little bit of the diplomacy that the French engaged in with the American Indians. The French were friends with the Algonquins and the Hurons. And this is going to basically be why you've got the French, even today, the French speakers prevalent in the Canadian province of Quebec. Okay, the Iroquois League, however, in upstate New York, they prevented the French from spreading south into New York and parts of the Ohio Valley because the Iroquois League was not on friendly terms with the French, all right? So what is the impact of all of this? Well, the French and the British did have an impact on the Eastern Woodland Indians. One of the things is that it helped to decimate these peoples by disease because the French were giving their allies guns. You're going to have gun warfare is going to kind of up the ante, so to speak, when it comes to Native American on Native American violence. But then you're also going to have the spread of alcoholism, sadly enough. And it is these things that are going to lead many American Indians to view any contact with Europeans as a dangerous proposition. As I just said, the European weapons deeply intensified the American Indian warfare in the Eastern Woodlands, that it would last during the last three decades, I should say, of the 17th century. And so in places like the Ohio Valley, you're going to get the Beaver Wars, where the Iroquois, who were allied with the English and the Dutch, wage war on the Huron and the Algonquin tribes and just devastates the population there. You also get something called the Mourning Wars, not like Good Morning Wars, but mourning, as in they were in mourning. And this one is one in which the Iroquois attacked neighboring tribes to replace the people that they had lost. And so they're going to basically kidnap people and bring them back and turn them into tribal members. This is, again, something that you've seen in a Hollywood film if you've watched Dances with Wolves. Okay, now later on, there was another war called King William's War that took place in 1697. This is when the French armed their Huron and Algonquin allies, and because of that, they were able to force the Iroquois into neutrality. The Iroquois basically said, yeah, we're not going to have any of that. And so the Iroquois are going to now start to turn to diplomacy when they're dealing with Europeans after the year 1700. And by 1760, the Indians in this region agreed not to kill each other. In essence, what you're going to get is a revitalization. Indians hoped that if they could band together, if they could eliminate alcohol, they could hopefully revitalize their life, their culture, their way of life, and that would help protect them against the European invaders. Now, another war, and I know there seems to be quite a bit of wars that we're talking about here, and we're going through them pretty quick, but the Chickasaw Wars of 1721 through 1763. France was struggling to maintain control at this point of Louisiana. This is now the 18th century. In the 17th century, France had been extremely powerful, but the French king, Louis XIV, sometimes referred to as the Sun King, engaged in numerous wars throughout his reign, and most of which France either just lost or if they won, they didn't really win much. And so things are really, the French economy is not doing well right now. He's no longer on the throne, but the after effects are definitely being felt. And so the French are having trouble hanging on to Louisiana. And this conflict is going to pit the French, who are allied with the Choctaws, against the British-supported Chickasaws in the northern Mississippi and western Tennessee region. Now, what's going to happen is that the Chickasaws are going to be able to prevent the French from dominating this area. And this is kind of the beginning of the end of French power in North America. But we're going to leave that part of the story for a different podcast. And so that brings us to New Spain. And when we're talking about the New World, or North America, I should say, and New Spain, we're going to deal right now with the Pueblo Indians in the American Southwest. This is the area that I live in, and I find it quite fascinating. But their name of the game here was conversion and exploitation. A French conquistador named Juan de Oñate comes up through from Mexico. He crosses into modern-day El Paso and then up into New Mexico, and he's going to establish the Spanish province of Nuevo Mexico, or New Mexico, in 1598. And one of the things that he had been instructed to do was that Spanish authorities had told him to deal less harshly with the American Indians than the previous conquerors or conquistadors, such as Cortes and Pizarro. Okay. Having said that, he kind of says, yes, sir, three bags full, and then he just goes about his way and does what he was going to do anyways, which is to deal with the natives very cruelly. In the year 1598, in July, Oñate demanded that the Pueblo chiefs had to swear allegiance to Spain, and they had to convert to Catholicism. Okay, and not all of them agreed. And so Oñate ended up retaliating against the Pueblo Indians at a place called Acoma by killing 1,000 natives and then enslaving 500 others. The male captives each had one foot cut off. Now just think about that for a minute. You're cutting off a foot. I don't know what he expected to achieve by this, but it's not going to endear him to the native peoples. Okay, the brutality, of course, would continue. And then in 1609, Oñate is finally removed from power in Nuevo Mexico. Coming out of this, the Pueblos submit to Spanish demands for labor and food, especially during drought conditions. But there is this simmering resentment that is just underneath the surface there. And in 1610, Santa Fe becomes the capital of New Mexico. And actually, the governor's mansion that is still in Santa Fe remains the oldest public building in the United States today. So, the Spanish are now going to develop something called the encomienda system. Remember, we talked about the forced labor. The Indians are forced into doing unpaid labor to do things like build roads, buildings, and other infrastructure in these towns. Pueblo villages are required to pay tribute to their Spanish leaders. And all of this is part of what is called the encomienda system. It's basically European-style feudalism brought to the New World and imposed on the natives by this governmental structure. You can see that this is far different than in the Great Lakes region. There was no state power, and so the Europeans had to engage in peaceful commerce. Now, the Spanish are also going to forcibly seek to Christianize the American Indians. Okay, the Franciscans, and I said the Dominicans, but it's the Franciscans with the Spanish, so my bad. But the Franciscans founded the missionary system in New Mexico in the 17th century. Later on, they would also found missions in California and Texas in the 17th and 18th centuries. But the Franciscans forbid the practice of American Indian religion. These practices then are driven underground. As we see today, you know, you're not going to pass a law that says, okay, you can't drink alcohol if you're under 21. You can, sure, you can pass the law, but we all know plenty of people that ignore those laws, okay? The same for, like, marijuana. You know, you pass a law, but it still is being consumed anyways. It's the same thing here. They passed a law forbidding the practice of American Indian religion, and so it just goes underground. At this time, in New Mexico, there are droughts that are taking place. If you haven't ever been out here, it's pretty dry, but it's drier than normal, and there's a high mortality rate among the American Indians in New Mexico, and that's going to undermine their faith in Christianity. But like I said, the Franciscans aren't just in New Mexico. Tucson, in modern-day Arizona, is established as a Spanish outpost in 1701. In Texas, you're going to get in 1716, a mission system established, and that includes San Antonio, which, of course, you're going to have the Alamo. California, you're going to get Spain concerned by the fact that the British and the Russians are expanding into northwestern America, especially after 1763. And so the Spanish are going to seek to settle in what they called Alta California to effectively control the region. And they do this thanks to a guy named Father Junipero Serra. He founds the first mission in San Diego in 1769. Coming out of that, you're going to get 20 missions. There's four presidios, which are just forts, military bases, to help protect the missions. And you're going to get a royal road connecting all of them together, the Camino Real. And that's different from the Camino Real that goes from Mexico City up through modern-day Chihuahua, Ciudad Juarez, to El Paso, and then on up through modern-day Las Cruces in New Mexico, Albuquerque, and then finally terminates at Santa Fe. That's a different Camino Real. One of the things that comes out of this is you're going to get Spanish mission architecture. It's going to come to influence the building of many schools and homes and public buildings throughout California's history. And then finally, in 1769, you're going to get vaqueros. These are horsemen and cattle herders coming up from Spanish Mexico. They first arrived in 1769 in California, and they start to work on ranches in the region. And so one of the things that's going to happen is that you're going to get the transmission of cowboy culture into the United States, and that's going to be the foundation of the American cowboy. Rodeo, for example, is a Spanish word that comes into the American English lexicon. Even cultural traits and traditions, such as the corridos, these are Spanish or Mexican songs and ballads, are going to blend with other cultural influences here in the Southwest. And you're finally also going to get intermarriage. I should mention intermarriage creates a distinctive Latin American culture here in the Southwest of mestizos. And the mestizo culture is a mixture of the American Indian and the Spanish cultural tradition. So that's at least one good thing that comes out of this. A negative effect, of course, is the caste system, or a casta system, that emerges in New Mexico. And it's similar to what existed in Mexico, in the Caribbean, and in South America. Now, we haven't really talked too much about war yet, but for the Spanish, but here we go. You're going to get the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. This takes place in New Mexico. As I said earlier, the Pueblos had been very much resentful, or the Pueblo Indians, had been very much resentful of their treatment by the Spanish, especially when it comes to the fact that they couldn't practice their religion. And so the Pueblo Revolt against Spanish rule in New Mexico and actually expelled them for over a decade. This is the most successful Native American rebellion against a European empire throughout the history of European empires in the New World. So what happens? Basically, they're going to end up killing about half of the Spanish clergy in New Mexico and over 350 Spanish settlers. As I said, part of this was because of the cruel treatment that the Spanish subjected the Pueblo Indians to. But there were also some other causes. You had the famine of 1666 caused massive suffering amongst the Indians. Remember, they're at the lowest rung on the caste system, so things like famine and drought are going to affect them more. The Pueblo Indians were also attacked by Apache and Navajo tribes, who were retaliating against Spanish aggression against their people. And so the Pueblos were kind of caught in the middle there. And then Spanish authorities also punished Pueblos for backsliding from Christianity to depending on their native religions. After major epidemics wiped out some Pueblo villages. So all of these things are going to just really get the Pueblo Indians upset, and they successfully revolt against Spanish authority. One of the things that comes out of this is that many of the Spanish are going to, as they evacuate New Mexico, they're going to settle in what is modern-day El Paso, Texas, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico area. And they're going to create some missions here, one of which is Isleta. There's another one down in Socorro, and then another one down in San Elizario. These are also, I should say, not just Spanish people, but some of their Pueblo, they still had a few Pueblo allies, and those Pueblo Indian allies who come with the Spanish are going to settle in what is now currently modern-day El Paso. Now, eventually, Spanish authorities do regain control in the early 1690s, but you're going to get another full-scale revolt erupting in 1696. And so by this time, the Spanish authorities are finally forced to compromise on the issue of religion. They realize, okay, we've got to calm down here. And American Indians are allowed to practice their beliefs as long as they attend Catholic Mass on Sundays. So it's kind of becoming a little bit like Roman religion. It was not really that you have to believe, but you need to show public allegiance to it. So you got to go to Mass. Now, just as in Latin America, American Indians in the Southwest are going to then start to develop a hybrid of Catholic beliefs mixing with indigenous beliefs and practices. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in more in depth in a future episode. But in 1706, Albuquerque is founded by Spanish soldiers. But in Albuquerque, you don't get the encomienda system. Here, Indian religion is tolerated, again, just as long as they attended Catholic Mass, because look at the date, it's 1706. Now, a couple of other things that come out of this. Spain introduces horses and sheep, which ended up transforming the region economically. One of the things that we tend to associate with, like the Plains Indians, for example, is the horse. But that, of course, was introduced by the Spanish. The Spanish eventually introduced schools, hospitals. They brought up printing presses. And so those are all positive things. But, again, the overwhelmingly negative effect of all this is that nearly 90% of the Pueblo population dies between 1550 and 1680. And so what can we say about all this? Well, as I've already touched on several times, when you have a lack of state power, the settlers or the traders or whatnot, they tend to be more accommodating of the people that they're dealing with the American Indians, and they tend to engage in peaceful activities. But as we see with Spanish efforts in North America, particularly before the Pueblo Revolt, when you have state power, these Europeans are going to behave far more ruthlessly and cruelly. Okay. Having said that, The natives are not just here to be kind of like the red shirts in Star Trek, that they're just going to get shot and killed, and that's their job. They're, you know, cannon fodder. The American Indians fight back, and in the Southwest, they're successful to some extent. They are able to force, through arms, they are able to force the Spanish to accommodate some of their culture here in the Southwest, allow them to still practice their religion, things like that. Okay, so that's this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you are enjoying these podcasts, please feel free to go to the American History Podcast. That's our website. And sign up for our email updates. I don't email you too much, maybe once a week at the most. So please do that. And anyone who is on the email list this fall, when our first digital ebook comes out, you will have access to that for free. Also, please, if you do enjoy this show, share it with your friends, family, coworkers, whatnot, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever social media platform you enjoy. And most importantly, it helps keep the show free. Please give us a review on iTunes, a good 5-star review on iTunes. Really does help attract more listeners. So until next time, have a good day.